Two top Google executives have joined forces to write the new book, The New Digital Age, Reshaping the Future of People, Nations, and Business. The book examines a number of different challenges that will arise as cyberspace drastically changes in the coming decade. The book asks two central questions: how will states continue to operate in both the cyber and physical world? And how will 5 billion additional internet users affect the global community in the near future? Jared Cohen is director of Google Ideas, a think tank set up by Google dedicated to understanding global challenges by applying technological solutions. Eric Schmidt is executive chairman of Google, where he served as CEO from 2001 to 2011, a member of the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. Schmidt also chairs the board of the New America Foundation and is a trustee of the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey. Jared Cohen and Eric Schmidt join us this morning. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Thank you, Joe.
Give us a sense of, when we talk about the new digital age, of where we are in that age.
This is Eric. When we look at what's going to happen, it's overwhelmingly good. And it's mostly because of the arrival of mobile devices for people who have had no information at all. So if you think about it, you've got 5 billion people or so who are going to join the internet over the next 5 to 10 years. They're going to upgrade their existing, shall we say, dumb phones to these smart browser-based phones. And when they do that, they're going to have access to all the world's information, all the entertainment, all the narratives, all the education, all the medical care. Their lives being safe and growing and good economics are good for America. In America, we're also going to see a huge explosion in the kinds of things we can do. Think of amazing personal digital assistants that will tell you what's going to happen, predict things, help you out with your daily life. All of that will happen much quicker than anyone ever thought.
And Jared, with that said, there is a somber tone that you take in part of the book, because with that comes great responsibility.
Of course, and part of the reason we decided to write this book is we were tired of what seems to be the dominant present-day debate, which focuses on, is technology good or is technology bad? And such a debate neglects the inevitability of 5 billion new people coming online. And so what we chose to do is write an honest account of the good and the bad that awaits us. Now, anybody that watches the news, reads a paper, goes online to see what's happening, knows that the world is not perfect. There's terrorism challenges, there's rogue state challenges, there's huge poverty and inequality challenges. Our book looks at, when 5 billion new people come online, how technology empowers people both for good and for ill, and what we do about it.
And Eric, with that good and bad that await us, how much do we know and how much is lurking that we're not sure of?
You know, I think that we can sort of see the next 5 years, and we know that the scenario I described around mobility and access to information will happen. What we don't know is how many bad people there are and what they'll do with that infrastructure. So you could imagine, for example, evil gangs finding hackers and together combining them to build new ways to attack the cyber infrastructure. You could imagine governments deciding that they don't really want you to know everything that's going on. Think China here, that export censorship and try to keep their people in a state of denial. So these are things we talk about in the book. We also think there are good political and technical solutions to them, but they need to be worked on.
And one of the ways that we discuss this in the book is, to the extent that everything between individuals that seek to promote good and individuals that seek to wreak havoc is collaborative, we argue that in the future, everybody is going to be connected. For people on the side of good, that means more witnesses. That means the ability to collectively press rewind, as we saw in Boston. That means a partnership between law enforcement and citizens on the ground. For those that are terrorists and criminals, what it means is the room for error becomes more significant. If you saw the news in the last week, there was a story of a $45 million ATM heist worldwide. And what was extraordinary about this is you had hackers and professional criminals who were good at being invisible, who found that they still needed street criminals to go to the ATMs. And the street criminals posted photos of themselves online bragging with $40,000 in cash. And in a networked world, if somebody's a criminal and makes a mistake, the entire network comes unraveled.
What happens, though, when we look at the world as white hats and black hats and good and evil, and there are those players in the world that look at you, that look at Google, and say, you're the evil ones.
Well, we obviously don't agree with that, so I need to have some more specifics. Google is organized around getting all the world's information to everybody, and we do so largely for free. So I would sort of say that's a pretty good starting mission, and let me know what your complaints are.
Well, and certainly you know the complaints that have come in around the world of people that are trying to suppress what we here in the Western world have.
Well, that doesn't make them right.
Of course not.
The human condition requires information. Jared and I traveled to a number of very unpleasant places, most notably North Korea, which is still very closed, Myanmar, Burma, which is now opening up, where we saw what happens when you don't have information. And now with these modern tools, the citizens can keep their governments, even if they're unelected, somewhat honest. Looking at China, they have a site called Weibo, which is their equivalent of Twitter and Facebook, which keeps the bureaucrats honest. And indeed, after they suppressed information about the train accident, ultimately caused the government to eventually investigate and, in fact, jail the head of the train division.
And I would add one other piece to this, which is 57% of the world's population lives under some kind of autocracy. That 57% of the world's population also happens to be some of the poorest people on Earth. What we found in our travels to 30-plus countries, places like Myanmar, Libya, Afghanistan, Pakistan, is in these environments you have large numbers of people who have heard of the internet even though they've never used it. And their understanding of the internet is associated with free speech, freedom of assembly, civil liberties that they wouldn't otherwise have when the world was entirely physical. So what we found is that the internet is even more powerful than just a resource and just a tool. It's powerful as an idea. And as an idea, it's permeating these autocratic societies and challenging an era where people knew no civil liberties.
When you went to North Korea, for example, does it surprise you then when that trip alone raises the hackles of some in Washington, John McCain for one, who says that it's a self-appointed delegation of useful idiots?
Well, Senator McCain is a great American statesman. However, he's wrong on this particular case. I don't know how we're going to deal with North Korea going forward, but I can tell you that the sanctions strategy of the current U.S. government is insufficient to have a big impact because the borders are porous and they had lots of products that they were getting through China and other mechanisms, including many American products. So it seems to me that a straightforward analysis says the best way to fix things in North Korea is to empower the citizens of North Korea, who are the most sheltered. They have no textbooks, no radio, no information. They don't know what's going on in the world. Get them some information and trust that they will, out of their own goodness of their hearts and their own caring about people, go and put pressure on their government to become a little bit less dangerous.
And Joe, as somebody who worked in government for 4 years, the observation that I made then and that I'll make now is dictators in the future and autocracies in the future are going to find themselves facing quite the dilemma. And the reason I say they face a dilemma is because for them, technology is both a carrot and a stick, and they don't know how to make sense of that contradiction. It's a carrot in the sense that countries like North Korea, you know, other countries that are autocratic, they cannot develop and grow economically if they don't at least open up some kind of access. And it's a stick in the sense that by opening up access, you empower the population to challenge what in North Korea is a cult of personality. Somebody has to talk about the technological path that the North Koreans need to go down. And our view is government will do their top-down thing to the extent that the private sector can play a valuable role from the bottom up that helps citizens. We want to do that.
You mentioned your government time working in the State Department. So with that said, Jared, can't autocracies keep the internet out, though?
There's only two countries in the entire world that have kept the internet out, and one of them is already finding that the walls that they set up are reasonably porous, and that's Cuba. North Korea never let the connectivity in the first place, but even North Korea is beginning to very, very slowly change. Go ahead, Eric.
Even the most brutal dictator cannot run the country without some level of connectivity. So on a go-forward basis, I think we can say we will be able to talk to the citizens in these repressive regimes somehow.
And we make the argument in the book that there's no country that's worse off as a result of the internet's arrival.
So with this, of course, comes the issue of privacy versus security. And you, I mean, you make the case that there will be, and if there isn't already, this absence of a delete button. There are things that are on a permanent record. How do we as people come to terms with that?
Since you asked the question about people, there's two arguments that we make in the book. One, technology and more connectivity does not absolve us as humans of responsibility to exercise good judgment. And two, as kids are coming online younger and faster in an era where people put their sonograms online, I'm very upset that parents are putting their sonograms online without at least getting a squint or a subtle smile from a newly born baby. But our argument is, as kids come online younger and faster than at any other time in history, parents are going to have to talk to them about the importance of data permanence years before they have the sex talk.
And this data permanence issue is quite profound. If you look at this this whole kerfuffle last week about the fellow who came up with the story about the 3D printing of the gun.
Right.
This American citizen thought, I guess he was doing good work by publishing a recipe to make guns that could not be detected. I'm not quite sure why he thought this. Eventually, the State Department asked them to take it down because it violates munitions laws in their view. By virtue of the fact that the public media spent so much time talking about it, it got even more attention to the fact that this guy, who I would view largely as an idiot, had done this. And now, of course, the copies of this information, which can be used to hurt people, is all around the world and outside the United States. Not a good scenario, a good example of data permanence.
So the question comes, Eric, of, and I guess it's obviously a complex question, and that is, what's Google's role in the future of online privacy? And I guess I can even expand that to, when we're talking about this new digital age, and as the subtitle of the book suggests, reshaping the future of people and nations and business, and the incredible importance that this has in our lives, how much of that is up to you as a company and working with other companies? I certainly understand the entrepreneurial spirit, but because of the great stakes, how do we work together to make that click and avoid future concerns, especially when it comes to security and privacy and cyber terrorism?
I think from a Google perspective, the most important thing for us to do is to make sure that the information that we store is in fact secure. We owe it to our users worldwide that the information that we collect, of which there's much, is not released and violating your privacy. So that's our sort of primary duty. With respect to things like cyber terrorism and cyber war, that's really the responsibility of governments. When Google was attacked by China, I learned that we're not allowed to attack back. Only governments can attack back. And so we, of course, you call the FBI calls in the NSA, and then there's a process that they follow. But Google's responsibility at some basic level is to protect the information that you give us so that others cannot use that to violate your privacy.
You mentioned China. What is Google's relationship now with China?
Well, after the attack and after the censorship policies that they put in place, which have only gotten worse, and after their tormenting of dissidents through Gmail and other technologies, which we discovered, we decided to largely move our search operations to Hong Kong, which is governed under a different rule. They always say we have, you know, one government but two systems. And so I said, well, we like the other system better. So Google is available in mainland China, fully available in Hong Kong, is available in mainland China. However, the Chinese government does apply its censorship to Google results along the way.
Jared, when you look at one of the things that you write about in the book, and it was one of the most powerful things that I read in the book, which is that ultimately this power of information is underrated. How so?
Let's take education as a starting point. One of the arguments that we make in the new digital age is, if you believe, as we do, that poor educational systems all around the world are at least in part at the source of all the world's problems, let's look at the status quo, which is most of the world, if they're learning at all, teaching their kids through rote memorization. And in certain parts of the world that are radicalized, you know, teaching kids really bad things through rote memorization. In the future, when every child has a smartphone in their hands, they're going to, for the first time, have a weapon to fight rote memorization and bad educational systems with critical thinking, interaction, and informal education.
Give them a choice of ideologies and not condemn them to be the slaves of these ideologues that force them into these evil acts.
So give them tools and allow them to understand them.
I mean, the reality is nobody's born wanting to be a violent extremist. It's, as Eric mentioned, an absence of choices and an absence of alternatives, and a smartphone is an intervention that gives an outlet.
I was struck in the book by whether we're talking about Cleveland or if we're talking about North Korea or China or Burma, that we are ultimately talking about children and their role.
You know, I think everybody wants the children of the world to have a better opportunity than they do. And one of the great things about our analysis in the book is that in most cases, they will. Most children are growing up in abject poverty here without access to information, education, entertainment, or medical care. So just think of the basics, right? And these are human beings just like us, just as smart as we are, stuck in a bad system, radicalized by bad people, and so forth. It will benefit us to have them become a middle class. They will become future customers of America. They will become consumers. They will become like us, which is a good thing.
And they also will know more about technology than their parents and their grandparents, which will give them a comparative advantage in their societies as they come online.
I mean, you mentioned this a moment ago, but forecasting that in the next decade, the world's virtual population will outnumber the physical population. So what does that do for data, and what will it do ultimately for empowering citizens?
Well, we like talking about what it will do in terms of challenging dictators and creating dilemmas for dictators, which is a nice thing to think about in the future. So let's take a country like Iran, which is about to go into a presidential election next month, and nobody knows what will happen. In the physical world, Iran has a population of 72 million people. Roughly a quarter of them are online today. In the future, when everybody's online and has multiple email accounts and multiple social networking profiles and multiple chatting services, the Iranian population online will look more like 500 million people. That's a lot of noise. That's a lot of activity. That's a lot of challenges to the regime. You know, my sort of message to those autocrats is good luck figuring out what's noise and what's real. And ultimately, democracy is on the right side here.
And the downside, Eric?
I think the empowerment bias is profound. It also empowers people who want to do evil. And the determination of whether people are going to do bad things or good things is largely cultural. And there will always be psychopaths. There will always be people who are dangerous. We will do a better job of detecting them because it's very difficult to completely hide your tracks if you're an evil person from the police in the internet. In the book, we talk about a Taliban commander who we heard about, who had managed to cover up his tracks on cell phones for a year, and then one day makes a mistake because he wants to go to his cousin's wedding, and 45 minutes later, he's apprehended.
When it comes to our understanding of the internet, of our understanding of what is possible, of our understanding of even what is possible with the device, the smartphones that we have at our disposal and we have in our hands, is it safe to say that most of us don't even scratch the surface of understanding that?
I would make a general statement that people are not used to the Moore's Law level of compounding of change. Moore's Law says that computation roughly doubles in performance every 2 years. There's essentially nothing in our daily lives, with the exception of computers, that doubles every 2 years in terms of price performance. Imagine if cars and gasoline and so forth fell in price for the same function every 2 years. What an extraordinarily different world we would have today. So the compounding of this rate of change is what is always a surprise. And we tend to underestimate in the long term what is possible. We know with modern artificial intelligence that new algorithms, new computers, new companies will come along with amazingly insightful things. It will help humans get the job done every day. In the book, we talk about you wake up in the morning and there's a big screen and you look at it and it says, "Hello, Eric." And I would say something to the effect of, "Do I need to get up?" And it says, "We have looked at all the things that are going to happen today and no, you can go back to sleep." That would be a very useful product.
Or imagine you're a nomad. You know, Eric and I went to a nomadic village in Kenya. You can imagine for a cattle herder in the morning whose big question is, where's the best place to get water? Where's the best place to take the livestock grazing? What are the prices today? You can imagine all of that being available on his or her smartphone at the time of waking up.
And with that information, do you think we are we intimidated by it? Do we, even if we don't truly understand it, do you think that we'll get better at educating people as to what is possible, given that it's all changing so quickly?
I would say that we've gone through a period of time in computing where the computer engineers were building products that only they could understand, to a new generation of products which are much more human, normal human designed. I always use the question of, can my mother understand it? Can she use it?
Right.
You know, a normal person, not a technical person. And I think we've made that breakthrough in the last 5 years. If you look at Google, Facebook, Amazon, you know, the leading online sites of one kind or another, they have amazingly new good human factors. And the next generation of startups, which are on Android and iPhones, have beautiful interfaces that explain to you what they're doing. So I think that breakthrough means that you will see the benefits of what I'm talking about without having to master the complexity. And that's a big deal.
And one thing that I would add that we talk about extensively in the new digital age is how people in environments that are poor and repressive will be the ones who come up with the most interesting ways to use the technology. So a fun way to think about this is we have Uber in the United States, useful for finding taxis. Women in Saudi Arabia can't drive. You could imagine them having an app that allows them to Uber a set of taxis that also have an anti-Mohabarat app that allows them to get behind the wheel of a car and evade the secret police.
This is, by the way, because the secret police wear these colorful outfits and we can recognize them.
As we wrap up, the two of you have written this book, and you have a shared voice in the book. And I was just curious as to how much of this is it Eric's opinion, how much of it is Jared's opinion, and how much of it is ultimately hope and a business plan for the company that is Google?
It's not a future roadmap for Google. Google doesn't publish one. It does reflect our joint collaboration, which I would like to inform everybody, was on Google Docs, which is an amazing product. And we would just sit there wherever we were, we would just write. And we had these crazy ideas. And then my daughter helped edit it. She's credited in the book as well. But I think it reflects the best judgment of a foreign policy professional and a technical professional about the future. And I'm looking forward to being judged as to whether we're right or not.
And the argument that I would add to this that we've been making as we've been out and about talking about the book is we don't believe that any one person could write this, because ultimately our future combines both, you know, the sort of world of expertise around technology with the world of expertise around geopolitics.
Well, it's a fascinating book and a fascinating roadmap. It's The New Digital Age, Reshaping the Future of People, Nations, and Business. It is published by Knopf. Eric Schmidt, Jared Cohen, I thank you very much for spending time with us, and I wish you all the luck in the world.
Thank you so much, Joe. You're fantastic.
Thank you.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book, The New Digital Age, Reshaping the Future of People, Nations, and Business. The book is published by Knopf. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.